Bit about yourself when you joined the New York Fed?
Well, all right. I graduated from Columbia College in 1927, Columbia Law School in 1929.
So,
well, you don't have to make notes, so go ahead. So I'll go on. I was thinking you were going to write it down. You're not making handwritten notes.
No, I'm taking.
No, okay. I'll keep on going. I said I would go. Graduated Columbia Law School in 1929. I was in the general practice of the law downtown New York until 1934. I joined the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in September 1934 as assistant counsel. I was in the legal department, I guess it was until 1945, still with the title of assistant counsel. In the whole first years there, I wasn't doing entirely legal work, but as time went on, I did get involved in a number of administrative matters, and I think it was 1945 that I gave up completely my position in the legal department, and I think the title after that was assistant vice president, but at any rate, I was in the personnel department for a while, in the, I call it open market, that's the name of it, was securities department, was basically involved with open market operations, and then in government bond operations, and I was secretary of the bank, assistant secretary in 1940, and then I think it was 42 I became secretary and continued at that for maybe 8 years. In 1950, I became vice president and assistant to the president, and in 1952 became first vice president of the bank. And of course, then from there on, I was also alternate member of the Federal Open Market Committee, and I retired from the bank as an officer in 1973 when I was 65, but at the request of the directors, I continued to serve the bank as a consultant through 1976. Well, I guess that's
okay.
My background.
That's a summary. When did you first have contact with Alan Sproul?
Well, when I first got in the bank, I suppose, was in 1934. Mm-hmm. When I began to work closely with him within a couple of years after that. And then many of the... I suppose after a few years I had been in the legal department, I also did odd jobs for Alan.
So you had a good working relationship.
Indeed, I did.
From the very beginning. And,
yep.
And that's especially interesting. You had close contact with Sproul and then Hayes.
Yes.
Sproul and Hayes had different sorts of personalities. Sproul had a personality where he needed to, I don't want to say exactly dominate, but he had very strong convictions, and he felt a compulsion to act on those convictions. Hayes, on the other hand, was more willing to work within the system, work with the chairman, and be part of a...
whom are you talking about, Sproul or Hayes?
I'm asking you to compare the two, what I'm asking you is that my impression is they had very different personalities.
Yeah, all right. Well, now let me tell you a little bit. Go back to when I said I became first vice president.
Yes.
That was in 52.
Yes.
In 56, Alan decided to retire.
Yes.
And he recommended, and the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank chose me as president of the bank in 1956. But the Federal Reserve Board, it would not approve that. And I was told by some of our directors that the reason the Federal Reserve Board declined to approve that was the, if you want to call it, the antagonistic posture of Alan Sproul and Bill Martin, who was chairman of the board.
Yes, I'd heard that story, but I hadn't heard it confirmed.
Bob Black is fully familiar of it with that in my case, and you know his own case.
Yes, it was.
Boyd refused for a long time to approve the appointment of Bob as president, and his director set it out. Just sat on it, and then the board finally came around and did it. In New York, the board didn't want to give the appearance of showing a rupture within the system and bowed down to the Federal Reserve Board decision.
Yes, that's the story I had heard. And was Bob this?
Well, I'll go on. No, just let me go on. So with that. Decision, then the board had its own proposed candidate, and the Federal Reserve Board and the Board of Directors of New York Bank, of course, had me, and then when that didn't work, the New York Board chose Alfred Hayes as the president. Now, Alfred Hayes was a very competent, very pleasant person, and throughout our entire relationship from then on, he consulted me on every matter. We worked together very, very well indeed, and I participated actively in all decisions of the bank, including monetary policy and so forth.
Let me ask you about Sproul and the board. There were two main institutional changes that effectively gave Martin control over monetary policy. One was the abolition of the executive committee.
What you're saying that Martin was given complete control over monetary policy?
No, there was a shift in power from, New York and the board had competed for a long time over which was going to be the dominant.
That's right. And there was a growing antagonism between Allen and Bill Martin, when that finally spelled out as it did, since I was Sproul's man, I was kaput as far as the board was concerned.
There were two basic institutional issues. One was up until 1955, I guess, the monetary policy had basically been made within an executive committee.
That is correct.
And by changing to a format which met every 3 weeks and which included all the regional bank presidents, that was a forum where Martin could exercise more influence.
Well, let's say it this way: it took the power. There was no longer any executive committee, and the whole committee met, and the whole committee made the decisions.
But
now, to the extent that any member of the committee felt he had a particular view, he expressed it.
That's right. But Martin had much more influence with the regional bank
president. That is correct.
So that gave him a degree of influence that he didn't exercise. So
that's correct.
And the other issue was whether the system open market account manager was going to report directly to the New York president or whether he was going to report to the FOMC, that is Bill Martin. That was the other key issue.
That was another issue. Now, the Federal Reserve Bank conducted the open market operations, and it seemed intolerable to us that the person who was dedicated to take that out was going to report to somebody else, whereas the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had the power and the responsibility. It was delegated the responsibility by the Open Market Committee to go into those transactions.
Sproul also had, there were certain, beyond those institutional arrangements, which determined the relative influence of New York and the board, there were also certain matters that, of principle, that Sproul felt very strongly about. The most famous one, of course, is bills only.
Yes. That was a big point on the part of the board, the bills only. But you know, when push came to shove, they had to abandon it.
You mean Operation Twist in the...
Operation what?
You mean in 1960 they abandoned it with Operation Twist. Is that what...
Whatever it was, I've forgotten what it was called.
Were there other issues beyond Bills Only?
Those were the principal issues, but I think the basic issue was to reduce the power of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and to increase the power of the Federal Reserve Board.
Purely in terms of economics and kind of how these individuals looked at the world, do you think that it would have made a difference to monetary policy if Sproul had been the dominant player as opposed to Martin?
Well, now, I don't like this talking about A dominant to B and so forth. I don't know what would have happened. I mean, I think it is clear that if the Open Market Committee rejected the concept of bills only and followed what had been the practice before that doctrine became such a hot issue, and made purchases where it thought that purchases were most desirable, I think it would have come out the same. It was just a delay for that period of time.
Okay, I think what I'm trying to do is to see if I can get some insight into how Sproul looked at the world, because we know a lot about Martin because he was Fed chairman for a long time.
Yes, he was.
When Sproul was head of the New York Bank, for most of the period you had the peg, the interest rate peg, so, the Fed...
Oh, really, that's right, yeah, but of course, for the long-term 2.5%, yeah.
Right, so it's it's harder to get a sense of, an understanding of how Sproul looked at... the Fed's responsibility for monetary policy. So I think what I'm trying to do is just to see if you have any insight.
Well, I think Sproul was flexible, but in his mind, his concept was to be flexible. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was bound by this 2.5% long-term rate and John Snyder's fear that he would have to finance a war in the Korean Peninsula and wanted to keep his interest rates low for that.
Sproul, after some initial opposition, Sproul supported the Bretton Woods system strongly, so he would...
Wait a minute, repeat what you said?
After some initial opposition, Sproul supported the Bretton Woods system strongly, is that correct?
Well, I guess you'd say, but check out the after opposition. Now, give you a little bit of background of the New York position.
Okay.
On the Bretton Woods. I don't know whether it was 43 or when it was, but people got talking what was the monetary system like P2P after the war.
Yeah, 45.
And they had a one-week series of meetings of our Board of Directors Committee on Foreign Relations, or whatever it was called, the Foreign Committee of the Board of Directors. And I was secretary of the bank at the time, and I attended all those meetings. Well, we had meetings first with Keynes, and I must say Keynes was a very polished gentleman. Of course, he had his bank corps, his unit, and these discussions, I say, took a couple of days. And then Harry White from the Treasury, he had his ideas, and I must say that Harry White was the most irritating person I think I have ever met. Certainly, the directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York were very much bothered by him, and I don't know to what extent Harry White's attitude and personality made it didn't make a good effect on the directors of the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, I don't remember the details of that, but the directors were. I think in these discussions, the big concentration was on monetary policies, which became the IMF after Bretton Woods. But there wasn't much talk about loans in the sense that the IBR, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and our directors were emphasizing the point that there was a great need for reconstruction loans, and don't just get involved with the IMF. Well, then it's that I think was a part of a feeling on the director's part that there's more to be done than what White wanted to do, and that I know that concept was important in the director's mind, that they should have reconstruction and development loans as well as this monetary fund idea. But then, of course, it came out that they had one institution for one and one and the other.
That's right. And later on, Sproul was offered the chief position at the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development.
Who was?
Sproul?
I don't know.
I read that someplace. He turned it down.
Well, I don't think he would. I didn't know. Maybe I knew it at the time, but I'm sure he wasn't interested in it.
Mm-hmm. How did Sproul get along with Mariner Eccles?
Well, very well.
Mm-hmm. And what about?
If you read Eccles,
Beckoning Frontiers.
In a biography, you may remember he said in there that Sproul was the smartest man in the Federal Reserve. He didn't say this, but of course I would say parentheses, except me, Eccles.
Yes.
You know, you never saw it. Not Eccles, of course. He was a very domineering person, but he recognized Sproul's capacity, and they worked well together.
So basically, they had the same kind of outlook on issues. In particular, what was depressing economic activity, the causes of the depression.
I don't know if they had all that background, but as far as what should be done,
yes,
they worked together.
Mm-hmm. What about McKinley?
Well, there was one thing I think. Eccles had the impression that when the economic situation was a lot of problems, you could open the spigot and make credit available. And then when you got over that hump, you could turn the spigot off.
Yes.
Sproul felt, you could open the spigot. But then when the time came to turn the spigot off or to turn it down, there were so many other factors that didn't make that sort of militated against turning it down adequately.
You wouldn't have to remember the debate over raising reserve requirements in 36-37, would you? And how Sproul felt about that. You remember the excess reserves were very large at that time, and the Fed raised reserve requirements sharply. Eccles thought that they would be tender for inflation later on.
Yeah.
I don't
remember that, no.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that there were the terrible excess reserves, but I don't remember opinions as to what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Eccles and Sproul worked together to get the accord.
Oh, yes.
So they must have, even though Eccles wasn't chairman any longer at that point, they still must have...
They did, and Eccles would come up and when they would talk to him even after Eccles was off the board, mm-hmm. they were good friends. I mean, I used to meet them there. I mean, I'd meet Eccles when he'd come up to New York.
What about McCabe? Did McCabe play any role in that, or was it primarily Eccles and Sproul who took the lead within the system on that?
Well, when Eccles and McCabe were both on the board, Allen clearly recognized that McCabe was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he participated very deftly with McCabe. He didn't want to, he recognized the importance of working well with McCabe, and he did work well with McCabe.
Mm-hmm. McCabe didn't stay for a long time as chairman. Do you have any impression of him as a leader, as a chairman? People say different things. Some people say he was a weak chairman.
I don't think he was a weak chairman. He was trying to, in a system that was boiling with problems and so forth,
mm-hmm.
he was trying to get consensus developed. And those that disagreed with his pleasant way of trying to do that may have thought he was a weak chairman. I would not call him a weak chairman.
Do you have any knowledge about why he left the system when he did?
No.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any, before we kind of go on to, you know, post-56, do you have any personal recollections of Sproul? Did you ever socialize with him? Or, you know, you obviously worked with him a lot. Any anecdotes or anything you can tell me about him before we go on?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, well. These are the kinds of things that just disappear if, you know, if they aren't noted. So if there's anything that strikes you about him.
I don't think that he was a socializer in any great way or had palsy-walsy with the officers of the bank. But we had a very pleasant relationship in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very much concerned about the welfare of everybody in the bank.
So he was a very good person to work
for. Oh, he was excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about Sproul's succession. Was Bob Rosa ever considered, or after the difference between your board and the Board of Governors,
you mean considered to be head of the Federal Reserve Bank?
Yes, after your nomination was vetoed.
Not at that time, no.
Mm-hmm. He was too young at that point, I suppose.
I don't know whether he was too young, or he was, I would say, he was not, I don't know what all the private discussions that went on about it,
mm-hmm.
but it would be my conclusion he would be considered as a junior and not in the running for that.
Sure. When did you begin to attend FOMC?
Well, let's see. I was, certainly I attended them from 52 on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think about this. I was secretary of the President's Conference. Alan was chairman of that, and I was secretary of the President's Conference for a few years, and I attended meetings in Washington, and I may have attended meetings of the FOMC, but certainly not many. After I became first vice president, I attended some meetings of the executive committee when Alan was not available, but when the normal rule, as you probably know, is that the first vice president in New York is alternate member, is the only, it doesn't attend there when the member is there. And whereas when the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond is an alternate, which is 2 years out of three, he attends the meeting. But the first vice president of New York doesn't attend because New York is already represented by the president. Now, when Al Hayes was president, he was involved a bit in many other in some foreign things. He took the whole system of foreign relations and so forth was changing, and there was a greater communication with the other central banks. And Al Hayes spent more time, I think, involved with foreign central banks than Alan did. And there were many times when did not attend the FOMC meetings, and I suppose over that period of time I attended maybe a quarter of them or maybe a fifth of them.
Mm-hmm.
That is from 1956 to 1973.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question about the Fed's relationship with other central banks and foreign exchange intervention.
The Fed's relationship with what?
Other central banks.
Yeah, okay.
In 1961, the FOMC engaged in a vigorous debate over whether it should engage in foreign exchange intervention. Up to that time, the Treasury's Exchange Stabilization Fund had purchased foreign currencies, but the Fed itself hadn't held foreign currencies in its own portfolio. There was a vigorous debate within the FOMC over whether the FOMC should get authorization from Congress to intervene in the foreign exchange markets. Do you remember that debate at all?
No, I don't.
Okay. I've read some of those minutes, and you were involved in those debates. In general, do you remember anything about the beginning of the swap arrangements with other central banks?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, I remember, of course, Charlie Cobus was very much involved in
that's right.
setting them up.
You don't remember why the full FOMC, why Chairman Martin didn't want to go to Congress to get authorization for swaps?
Well, I don't know, but I know that I have this recollection there in my whole life in the Federal Reserve was that there was a reluctance to go to the Congress to get authority to do this or to that or the other thing, because it felt once it got open with Congress, there were some fellows there in the Congress that would like to inject some other amendments which
sure.
would be considered very deleterious
sure.
by the Federal
sure.
Reserve System. So there was a very great reluctance to go to Congress for legislation.
Yeah, sure, sure. That's understandable. 1959 was a...
1959
was a difficult year for the Fed. There was an economic recovery, but the Fed had a balance of payments problem. The Treasury was losing gold.
I was losing gold, and we were creating the money to take that up,
The interest rates went up. I've read the FOMC minutes for that year. I've not read them for every year, but I read them for a few years. That's one of the...
Tell me, were you able to stay awake?
Well,
okay, go ahead.
Not at all. I didn't sit down and read them all at one. But what was interesting to me in that year in particular, formally there seemed to be two ways of giving instructions to the desk. One was through the directive, and one was through Martin's consensus statement, and the FOMC voted on each of those. The first time interest rates rose, there was a change in the directive, and that was clearly in something the full FOMC intended to have happen. But the second time interest rates rose in late August, and then again in early December of that year, there was no change in the directive, there was no change in the consensus statement, and in general there was no sentiment within the FOMC for raising rates. I'm just curious how that happens. The desk at New York would have had a target for free reserves, and then on the morning call, the head of the system open market account would have said interest rates are rising with our free reserves target, and you know Martin would have said, well, that's okay. So basically, that would have been his choice.
I really don't remember that. That I could give an intelligent comment.
In general, Martin's in. I'm curious about your evaluation of Martin's interaction with the FOMC. The full FOMC, and in particular how it changed over time. As of the early 60s, it was a very sympathetic FOMC, right? Mitchell was the only one who ever challenged the chairman. In general, I mean, do you remember any meetings that you attended where there was a significant disagreement?
Well, it was more a degree of a degree. Of course, I suppose one people would generally say that New York, well, this, you must bear this in mind, that the board is in Washington. The board is subject to all kinds of pressures by the executive and by the Congress. And therefore, this is my view, therefore they come indoctrinated in that. And they recognize that they must give very close attention to the views they hear from the executive and from the Congress. And when you add that all up, Washington is more inclined to go slowly on any pressure restraint than is New York, which is in the market and sees the direct effect of pressures.
Yes, I read the minutes for 61 also, and in the fall of 61, you were arguing vigorously for an increase in interest rates because of the balance of payments problem, and Martin wanted to go slow. So
I think it's quite understandable in just the nature of the system, as I said, and the same thing is going on today. You know, I mean,
yes,
the board is blamed, Bob, and any administration that doesn't want us, who wants to claim credit for anything that happens. It's good whether the administration is involved in it or not, and it doesn't want to see something happen that may cause the public to feel concerned about the administration. That's human nature.
Sure. Over time, the character of the governors changed with the appointees by Kennedy and then Johnson. The governors became much more liberal. Of course, Robertson had been around
for a
long time, since 52, I guess. And he was a strong personality, right? I mean, he had strong opinions, and he generally supported the chairman. They generally worked well together.
I think that's so.
Mm-hmm. But then Mitchell was appointed by Kennedy, and then
Mitchell was involved in Chicago. Now, I shouldn't be trying to say as to how Mitchell. No, I have nothing further to say.
Okay. You can. It's your choice. You can throw it away if you want.
I don't know enough that I can state anything positive, so I shouldn't say anything. But having said all that, I think that in the political system of the country, there was some indication that the refresh me. When did Matt Simchick leave the board?
Oh, gosh. 59, maybe?
Well, you know, Matt was from the Chicago area, and I think there was a feeling in Chicago that the Chicago area ought to be represented, and I think that's all I was going to say about Mitchell.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, then what I was saying is that then later on there was a group of liberal governors.
Maisel,
Bremer.
Yeah.
And then there were individuals that were could go either way, like Dewey Dane. Did it become over time? Did it become more difficult for Martin to handle the FOMC, or did he, given his personal skills, his personal charm, did he always manage to
Well, he was a very persuasive person, and. And pleasant in his discussions in general, and I think he continued to have a great influence. But I guess Maisel and others would talk, and they might dissent, but it wasn't a big dissent.
Mm-hmm. Things became, well, as long as Kennedy was president, the Treasury was pretty sympathetic with the Fed. The Treasury was concerned about balance of payments, and of course you had a lot of kind of sympathetic people in the Treasury. Dewey Dane was in the Treasury, and Peter Sternlight and Bob Rosa. But after Kennedy, then became a much more difficult environment.
Johnson wanted to have guns and butter, and that set off the whole inflationary binge.
Mm-hmm.
And he opposed an increase in the discount rate. You must know that story where the Federal Reserve banks would keep voting to raise the rate, and Bill would talk with the president. He was opposed to it, and then Bill recognized that they had to do something, and think the president recognized that logically something ought to be done, but he didn't want it. He kept postponing.
That must have been a long year for Martin. The other thing wasn't just increasing interest rates, but the banks were under pressure from the Johnson administration not to raise the prime rate. And yet market rates were going up above the prime rate. The rate on CDs was going above the prime rate, and the bond rate was going above the prime rate. So banks were under a lot of pressure. Corporations wanted to borrow from them. At the same time, their funding costs were rising above the prime. So New York must have been pushing pretty hard at that time.
Pushing hard? What do you mean?
For an increase in the discount rate.
For the discount rate? Well, that's so, yes. Now, as far as the prime rate is concerned, there was an awful lot of hassle about that. And as people in Washington had the view that there was a conspiracy among the banks in New York. Maybe I think that was their attitude. But they were thinking that there was the banks were really getting together and deciding that they were going to increase the prime rate. Well, now, as we saw it, we thought that banks weren't stupid enough to want to agree to increase the prime rate. But as conditions developed, it was obvious to the banks and, say, to us in New York, that the prime rate couldn't stay at the low point it was. And in just a matter of time, some commercial bank would raise the rate, and that was others would act right after it. And I remember when that happened, the first one to raise the rate would generally give us a call and tell us that. And certainly my position was, thank you very much, and not make any argument whether it was a good thing to do or whether it was not a good thing to do. And then report that to the Secretary of the Treasury.
But the first bank that tried that, I think, in the spring of 65 got called in to talk to the White House.
Oh, yes.
So that was it was
And then there was a big investigation. I don't know whether Justice got into it, I think, trying to find out if this was concerted action and violated the Sherman Act.
Okay, so the Fed raised the discount rate, and it raised Regulation Q, so banks could attract funds more easily. But then it turned out to be that created a whole separate set of pressures. The thrift industry, the S&Ls, came under pressure
as
rates rose. So really, maybe for the first time, the Fed came under enormous congressional pressure. Do you remember anything at the time about Wright-Patman and legislation to set a ceiling on interest rates?
Oh, yes, I remember that. Did you ever know Patman?
Well, he died before I came to work
if you've ever heard him talk, Les Rounds in the Federal Reserve Bank News, Bank of New York, used to say, well, he sounds like a Methodist minister when he talks, but you read something and it would sound very vitriolic, but you hear him say it was in a very calm, soft way. But of course, he was making a career out of denigrating the Federal Reserve System. My own opinion is he was a populist. He wanted free money and so forth, and to denigrate the Federal Reserve System would make it easier to have the free money.
Yeah, he actually came up to the New York Fed a couple of times.
Oh, yes, yes. As a matter of fact, one time, it was shortly, I guess, after the election, and there's a new people on his committee, on the banking committee, bank and currency committee of the House, and we set up a day in which he had presentations by the people in the research department and open market operations and so forth, and then I was involved, made some general remarks about the operations, and then we took them to the desk and saw that and had a whole day with him. Following that, a couple of the people who were members of this committee, now Morehouse of Pittsburgh area and Joe Barr were two of those fellows. And they were very much interested in how the system ran, and they came up several times and and took a look, so they would know for themselves and not just hear what Patman had to say about it. Well, you know, Joe Barr later became Secretary of the Treasury.
He took the position that Volcker had. And I think when Volcker left, I guess it was in 66, Joe Barr took his position. I think that's...
Well, Barr was Secretary of the Treasury before. When Volcker left as deputy.
Yeah.
Barr was there...
Fowler...
I don't remember this. Wasn't Joe Barr Secretary of the Treasury?
Fowler was Secretary of the Treasury, and Joe Barr was the undersecretary.
And then didn't they follow Joe?
No, I think Fowler stayed until Johnson left, and then Kennedy became Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon.
I don't know. I forget those things, I guess.
Barr was basically what Volcker was before. He was the undersecretary. He handled domestic and international. The Fed would have been, Barr would have been the one who would have been calling up to the New York desk and trying to find out why the... You know, interest rates were so high, that kind of thing. So he would have been the one who would have had the direct contact.
Yeah, I think he was a very understanding person.
That's interesting. Did you have any impressions of any other people at the Treasury, Fowler or?
I thought Fowler was good. I thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you. Let's go on. 66, that was Johnson's. Johnson was unwilling to raise taxes. He wanted both guns and butter. At that point, the council under Ackley was willing to defend the Fed, and the Fed raised interest rates in the summer of 66. Do you remember that and the problems in the financial markets?
Well, that's what I was talking about. Right. That Johnson resisted the small increase in the discount rate at that time.
Right. But the Fed, that was in 65, and then the Fed did raise the discount rate in December
of
65, and then pushed rates up, especially in late summer of 66.
I don't really recall whether something happened in 65 or 66. Those dates, it's just kind of a period that might not happen.
Oh, sure. Oh, no, no, that's, there's no reason.
No occasion to look back to know what years they came in.
There's no reason you should, but what I'm looking for is just kind of any insights and recollections you have as to what moved monetary policy in those days.
I have this feeling that when the escalation of the Vietnam War went on, and there were inflationary pressures, the administration resisted any change there, and this inflation then built up, and we're still paying for it.
Yeah. 68 was a especially difficult year for the Fed. You remember the surcharge and the Johnson administration wanted the 10% surcharge on income taxes. Martin held off raising interest rates as long as there was the surcharge was hung in the balance in Congress. Do you remember?
No, I don't remember that.
What about early 68 when the dollar was under attack and the Fed moved to a two-tier gold standard arrangement where it would buy and sell only among central banks.
Yeah, I know.
Do you remember? Do you have any sense of kind of what Martin was?
Tell me. Yeah. When they're talking about the gold, when did the Burns become chairman?
February 70. So this is.
It's the big problem of gold was after that.
Yeah. Okay, I think what I'm asking partly just is a general perception of to what extent your feeling is that Martin got the monetary policy he wanted in this period, and to what extent he was being pushed into a position by political pressures from Congress and from the administration. Do you think he basically got the monetary policy he wanted throughout this period, or do you feel like he was pushed?
I think he was pushed.
Well,
the same reasons that I said before about the Washington atmosphere.
And you think what he You think he did what he could, or
I do.
And you think he resisted as hard as he could?
I think so.
I think that's probably a fair summary. Burns became chairman in February 1970. Did you go to any FOMC meetings when Burns was
chairman?
Yes,
I did.
Do you remember the first one?
Well, I don't. New York and go around the table clockwise, and I was commenting on the conditions and thought that we ought to be a bit restraining, and he, I think, was very much irritated by that. I had the impression he was trying to, that he was highly influenced by the administration at that time. I'll give you this, you've talked this anecdote, I haven't told anybody else this, but when I said that, I've forgotten the details I gave, but I'll say in essence I thought they were showing some increasing pressures in the market. And he said to me, "Who says that?" And I said, "Well, I said it. You asked for my opinion, and I said it." So I suppose the I had difficulty with Burns.
When Burns came in as chairman, the Fed was following a very restrictive monetary policy. It was trying to get the inflation rate down from its 4% level in 69. When Burns came in, he moved the Fed away from that policy. He moved it to a, if not a restrictive policy, at least a moderately expansionary policy. There was a big... Initially, there was a big fight between Al Hayes and Chairman Burns over policy.
Yes.
The first meeting was very contentious. Do you remember any discussion of that initial FOMC meeting where Hayes and Burns, basically went head to head on whether monetary policy should become?
I was not president. It was clear to me that Burns. He did not like Al. Al resisted him, and I think that annoyed him very much. And that was evident throughout the time that Al was thereafter, where Al was at the bank, and it was very definitely shown in various relationships between the bank and the board.
Burns was basically rude to. Hayes at FOMC meetings and cut him off, and didn't want to listen.
Didn't want to listen to different views. That's right. And this was shown in relationship between the bank and the board on the building of a proposed building of a new building. But I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah, New York never did get the building, did
never
they?
Never did.
They got the land, but then they didn't.
They sold it. I'm not going to comment on it. It was a sad situation.
Yeah. I think I know I think I understand. And then again in 71, when the dollar was under attack, in the spring of 71, the New York Fed tried to prod the full FOMC into pushing interest rates up by recommending discount rate increases. Did you remember any of that period? This would have been before Camp David and the wage and price.
I don't remember anything specific. The pressure's there, yeah.
Yeah. We pretty much worked through this whole period. You said you retired in 73. 73. do you think the Fed could have done anything differently to over this period, or you know, the Fed basically did what it could do to resist inflation? Do you think it would have been different if there had been different personalities?
I think it would be safe to say that one might be expected that there were different personalities. Things mm-hmm. might have been different,
sure,
but
yeah.
I'm not in any position to comment on Allen's time. And before there was a week before there was an open market committee, we spent an afternoon besides Allen and me, there were with Bob Rouse, who was running the open market system, and Harold Rossi, and maybe sometime, no, not John Williams, he wasn't of those, Harold Rossi Research, and then other fellows who Harold was in charge with, and other fellows that with some would report on economic conditions, on imbalance, mm-hmm. payments problems. The fellow in charge of discount committee operations would report, mm-hmm. and we'd get that whole gamut of thought. As that expanded, then we're getting charts that were prepared on ectochrome, and they could project them. And so mm-hmm. we got a very good review of what things were. And mm-hmm. then Alan prepared what he was going to say, or Al prepared what he was going to say, and I prepared what I was going to say. And we were looking for someone as an advisor. I tried to hire Hazard Burns when he was teaching up at Columbia, and he reacted very nicely. He was pleased with the suggestion, but then he turned it down.
That's